This is FM 100.5 and 101.9. AM 1450, Rutherford County's place to talk. WGNS, Murfreesboro, your good neighbor station. This is The Truman Show with Truman Jones. A look at the politics, news, sports, and people that are shaping Rutherford County. Now your host, Truman Jones.
Good afternoon, Rutherford County. Going to be a great show. I have my really good friend Dan Whittle on today, and we're going to be talking about Canalu, and I think it's going to be interesting. Dan came from a very unusual area. Of course, you kind of associate him with being from an unusual area. But we want to let you know that the first part of this show is brought to you by At Home Care, Melissa Warren's business. And they come into your home 24-7, take care of all your responsibilities for you, even run errands. They make sure that you can live the type of life that you have dreamed of. And if you're having trouble keeping up with those responsibilities and maybe fearing that you may have to leave your home, you don't have to. Give them a call at 713-4639 or check out their website at www.athomecaretennessee.com, or you can go over to their place of business, which is at 237 Castlewood Drive, Suite H, and that's right behind the Kroger's on Memorial Boulevard.
Dan, it's a pleasure to work with the mouth of the Mid-South.
You shouldn't be saying that about Zach.
Well, I worked with the mouth of the South also. The mouth of the South was Jerry Clyer. Truman Jones is the mouth of the Mid-South.
Mm-hmm. Well, shoot up here amongst us. you have been one of my best friends for a long time.
Well, thank you.
And a lot of it is your unique sense of humor. You really do have a unique sense of humor. And you have a caring way about you. And life, you've always considered a blessing, which I really do like that. I like for people to always be upbeat, and no matter how bad things are or what's happening, you always are able to smile and share good things with everybody. And I used to read your column quite often. I mean, I really did.
And
I loved your column because you relate to people in the community that everybody likes to hear about.
And that's why you can claim to be culturally enriched, mm-hmm. the fact that you read my columns all
right,
these years.
Right.
Lord's been good to me.
Did you happen to read about, they're having the mosque trial going on? Or
I was the one they described as fluff and irrelevant.
Yeah. I've always heard it's just nice to be noticed no matter what it is. I'm not too sure anymore.
And anyway, I'll be glad when that mess is over.
Yeah, I will too. And I tell you what, you guys really do. I enjoy your newspaper. I really do, because it hits home. It talks about the community, and it we live in a place that I think that everybody that's been in Rutherford County, I don't care how long, everybody considers it's their home, and this is where they want to spend most of their time.
Well, we run a newspaper like Bart Walker runs WGNS Radio. We are community service. It's not rocket science. It's taking care of the people, and the people will take care of you.
Now, you have become or going to become a well-known author because you have just written a great book. And it's about Canalu. It's about home.
Canalu is a little swamp town that I grew up in the Boot Hill area of Missouri, right on the other side of the Mississippi River.
Now, tell me about the beginning of Canalu, because it's so interesting. Of course, I'm a history buff, and I love anything that has to do with history of Rutherford County. But I have been kind of catching up a little bit on Canalu.
Canalu is a throwback in that the frontier went all the way out to the west coast. Well, Canalu wasn't established in the swamps until 1902, so it was one of the last frontier towns in America.
Mm-hmm.
All right, the original settlers in 1902 literally floated into what became the settlement on log rafts.
Hold on a second there, young man.
You know, I was thinking while you were talking that there's a critic out there somewhere that does not particularly care what's going on right now.
Why in the world
did they pick when you were talking to put that on?
Story of my life, Truman. Yeah. But anyway, Canalu was one of the last frontier towns in America, established in 1902. The original settlers were timber people, and they floated into the swamp literally on log rafts. The original town was built up on stilts out of the water. The water in the swamp was much like Real Foot Lake.
What river did they come in on?
Mississippi.
Okay.
And it was much like the Real Foot Lake on the Tennessee side, okay, which is swamp also.
Been there, yeah.
And a very tough, rugged breed of people went into that swamp to open up the community, the timber industry, and the railroading industry. And a lot of the people who originally settled in the community were on the lam from the law in places like Arkansas, Tennessee, some of your relatives probably,
yeah,
Kentucky.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah. Very, very rugged, tough breed of people settled that swamp and carved a livelihood out of the swamp and the timber.
Now, what were they thinking when they came in here? You're mentioning timber, but would that have been their livelihood as far as why they selected that particular area?
Yankee timber companies came south and opened up that swamp. They had trees as big around as this room in the swamp, hardwood. And cane brakes was so thick you couldn't see but a few feet out in front of you. In fact, they had to carry compasses because the timber and the cane was so thick that you couldn't see the sun. So they would lose their way in opening up the swamp if they didn't have a compass with them because they couldn't use the sun to direct themselves.
Now, were any of the group that came in there, this is post-Civil War, of course.
1902.
Were any of them veterans or
yes.
What did they come as a large group?
The original town, about 200 people the first 10 years. They established a school in 1909. That's the year they incorporated Canalu as a village, as a town. The first post office, 1909. And I talked to one woman, Mrs. Florence Robinson Poe. She died last year at age 112. She had the distinction of living in three centuries, 1800s, 1900s, this century. And her memory, she remembered the hideout that Frank and Jesse James used. The cabin was still standing in the swamp.
Oh, that would be perfect for that.
Yeah. And her memory could remember last week, and she could remember a century ago. Just one of the most remarkable people I've ever met. And so she gave me a lot of that history.
Now, the background of these people that came in, were they of a particular group? Were they Irish, Scottish, or...
All of the above, but a lot of them were Irish and Scottish out of Kentucky.
So what part of Kentucky are we talking about?
The Paducah.
Western Kentucky.
Yeah,
part.
Western Kentucky. And a lot of them are this Mrs. Poe's parents came into the swamp with the idea they had oxen. The cows and the mules and the horses could not deal with the timber during the winter because of the heavy mud. All right, it took oxen to haul the timber out of the swamp during the winter months. That's what brought them into the swamp. His name was Wid Poe, and he made a small fortune with his oxen.
So when they cut the timber, how in the world did they ship it out of there? So, yeah, I presume it's not too far from the Mississippi.
It's 20 miles from the Mississippi, and there's a railroad spur line built down out of Cape Girardeau by Lewis Houck. Houck Fieldhouse at Southeast Missouri State University is named for Mr. Houck. He built what they call the Peavine Railroad, and that's what ultimately opened the swamp up and Canalu. The name Canalu is a foreign word, and it was given and coined by Mr. Houck, and the Canalu means where is the river, because it was all swamp. You couldn't tell where the river was.
Now, Canalu, is that French?
Yeah.
Is that a French word?
Yeah. Cana, French, yeah.
Now, once you got in there, did they actually have factories there?
Stave
sure
mill.
They set up probably
the first
grocery stores, those type
first,
things?
The grocery stores were in tents up on stilts up out of the water, saloons up on stilts up out of the water, and the first mill that was created in there, they made staves for whiskey barrels on site. They shipped timber out mostly, but they did have a stave mill there. Now, in fact, that's where I went to school, on the old site where the stave mill was.
It sounds a little bit like the swamps down in Louisiana.
We were very much like Cajuns. We weren't Cajuns, but we made great friends. We made bad enemies. Hmm. We'd burn you out.
Now, in that particular area, I mean, it's almost like you don't belong to any states at all. I mean, you're just almost on an island all by yourself. Because I've been into the Real Foot area, and
it's a different world.
It's an exotic area.
Yeah. The feuds and the fights were very serious. They didn't have mere fisticuffs. These people fought to the death. I mean, gunfights. Mm-hmm. The most recent gunfight was 1952, July 4th. It was a gunfight on Main Street, just like the old Wild West. Hmm. I did not see the gunfight, but I saw the aftermath of the gunfight with the guys being all bandaged up. They both lived, thank goodness. One of my earliest recollections of life, I guess I was three, maybe four. I was walking down the street with a neighbor farm man, a little mile on Main Street in the little farm town there, and a guy came out holding his guts in. He'd been knifed in one of the saloons. Mm. This happened just about every Saturday night.
So the law there, when they set it up for that town, of course you had to have a marshal or a sheriff or a police department. How did they formulate that? Because that would be interesting in a place that seemed to be almost lawless when you
it was in. The first marshal in Canalu at 1904 was a man that was actually on the lam from the law on a murder warrant out of Kentucky. The legend has it that he was
great lawman.
the legend has it that he was hired because he had experience with firearms, mm-hmm. and he had shot a deputy sheriff back across the Kentucky line on the other side of the Mississippi and got away with it. They were afraid to go in after him.
I presume that most people were armed when they came in there.
Very much so.
And when they set that up, I presume that part of the food that those people, when they first came in, that would be eating would be the wildlife that would be in that area.
Bears, panthers, of course, ducks, geese. You're right. The Mrs. Pohl, the lady I mentioned a while ago, lived to be 112, died last year. She remembers catching fish out her bedroom window.
Hmm.
And a panther attacked the family. Big black panther almost killed her brother.
Wow.
And the dad got there in time and shot the panther dead.
Now, you were talking about Jesse and Frank James earlier. And as we know, Missouri was a hotbed for people after the war that would just run wild over everything. Mm-hmm. They would have groups of people. Was that ever a place for those people to go and hide? It's just like one of the older hideouts where you would get away with nobody else would ever follow you.
My godmother was a cousin to Jesse and Frank James.
Wow.
We were not allowed to talk about that. They the James brothers had a cabin hideout in the middle of the swamp, very near my little farm town that we're talking about. That cabin stood until the 1930s, and in the cabin door was written the name Frank, Jesse, and Bob.
Wow.
Bob Ford.
I'm surprised they didn't cross that last one.
He's the dirty little coward that shot Mr. Howard.
Yeah.
But very tough breed of people, very smart breed of people. They carved a livelihood out of a virtual wilderness. And
it's hard for us in this day and time to relate to those types of hardships that they would overcome. And like any area, if you're depending on timber to make a living, sooner or later that's going to run out.
It did run out, and when it ran out in the 1920s, what happened next is one of the biggest dredging jobs, bigger than the Panama Canal, the biggest dredging job in history. When they dredged that swamp, it's a six-county farming region now. When they drained that swamp, some of the richest farmland in the world. it'll grow anything. Right now, it's big in rice. When I grew up, we raised cotton, corn, soybeans.
So how did they actually dredge that? That had to have been a monumental.
It was. They and a lot of the people that worked on the Panama Canal came up to Missouri to do that project, and there was 1,000 involved. And I've got pictures of the old dredging machines. It was an awesome project, especially in that era. We were not that advanced, but the American people have always been very, what would you say, adaptive.
Oh, they can, yeah, they are.
And so when they drained the swamp, that meant they can control the flooding, which allowed the farm phenomena to begin, the culture, which is what I grew up in, the farming culture.
We think of that type of land, and the first thing you think about, of course, is mosquitoes, smallpox, and all those type things.
They had diphtheria outbreaks, influenza. 1919, the biggest news event in the local newspaper in 1919 was the big flu epidemic that killed thousands in America. Mm-hmm. They had a double funeral for two little boys that died the same day with influenza, which was mosquitoes. By the way, the mosquitoes there is as big as horses almost till this day.
Yeah. I don't want to go there. now they've gone from being people who cut timber. Now they've got farmland that is set up. How does commerce work there? Because we're talking about a place that is shut off from the rest of the world, but yet are they pretty much working within their own system, or are they in the shipping industry also?
In their up through the 1960s, it was pretty much within the system. The railroad was the link out as far as commerce was go. We would ship our cotton
how close
and
were
soybeans.
The railroad?
Right through town.
Wow.
And it split our farm, the railroad did. And we would ship the cotton, soybeans, corn, we would ship to Cairo, Illinois on the Mississippi River via the railroad.
So your mom and your dad
1938
had a farm.
They moved up from Arkansas as sharecroppers in 1938. And dad was a gambling man, and he got paid a debt $1,000. And he went and bought 100 acres of land down payment with that $1,000 in 1938. That broke him, and the first night in Canalu, they arrived in horse and wagon, and they passed a little Pentecost church in Canalu, and they stopped and went to church, and Dad put the last nickel he had in the collection plate. And it was the next week when the guy came forward and paid a debt, the $1,000 debt. Daddy always claimed the Lord worked that out when he put that last nickel in. He brought that $1,000 in, made the farm possible.
We have always heard that the money that you give to the church will come back tenfold back to you. And evidently, that's exactly what happened.
You will not give God. These were very, very rugged people, very tough people. They were very spiritual people, too. And we had three churches, Baptist, Church of Christ, and Pentecostal. By the same token, we had seven saloons.
Now, kind of goes hand in hand there.
Yeah.
Now, as the community grew, you said there were about 200 people.
It started out
when
its
first
peak,
came in.
At its peak, 495 was the most people that ever lived in the farm town per se. Of course, during the 1940s and 1950s, on Saturday nights, it would be swamped with people, overrun on Main Street. You couldn't walk down Main Street. I remember this in the 1940s, 1950s. Farm people would come into town. We had a theater and seven little grocery stores. And so on Saturday nights, they would come in, party, buy their groceries, get their hair cut. And we had a barber that had was famous for his PA haircuts. And that was, he could give a haircut faster than you could smoke a self-rolled Prince Albert cigarette.
Now, you think about all the hardships that you went through, and then when the Depression came, did it affect a Canalu at all?
It did, but not in the sense that you think, because these were self-reliant people. They didn't have a lot of money to begin with, so they could produce their own food and livelihoods there in the wilderness and on the farms, and they actually made it better than a lot of people in the cities. Very self-reliant people. And the neighbors helped out each other. I remember barn buildings, and when barns would burn or something, I remember we would all gather and build the barn back for the neighbors. I lived in that era. Very privileged to live in that era. That was a blessed era.
Oh, it sounds great to me. I was teasing you a minute ago, but you're growing up with people that you know everybody there. You know all the families. You know what they're about and the roots. And I bet you once a young guy's in high school or whatever, he's already got his wife picked out and the family.
There was a lot of that.
Mm-hmm. I bet that was interesting.
We produced some very famous people. We called them famous then. Our little high school didn't exist except for 30 years. Mm-hmm. In that 30 years, we produced more than 45 professional educators.
Oh, really?
So we weren't dummies.
Well, that's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Did they? And I presume they moved out of that area and went other places.
That was
places.
Their ticket out. And we had
wait
college
a minute,
professors.
That's the ticket out.
Out of the farming economy that began dying in the 1960s.
Oh.
Yeah.
So you guys were almost trapped in an area where there was very few employment opportunities at that time.
When the mechanical cotton pickers came in and the big self-propelled combines came in, that ended the farm labor jobs. So everybody scattered to St. Louis for the car industry, to Flint, Michigan for the car industry. Educators, they became teachers. I had some of the best teachers in the world.
Now, what did that do to the business community as the exit started?
It died. It's a ghost town now. What a shame. The Main Street, there's not even a pay telephone on Main Street anymore.
You think of a town that's so vibrant like Canale was, and then all of a sudden it starts dying out. That's such a sad thing because, you know, that would have to be a little bit bitter to the people who came in and formed that area into a community that they were expecting that all their children and grandchildren and all that would grow there.
I knew at 5 years old that I wasn't going to be a farmer. I just knew that, in fact, I knew I was going to be a writer. I'm living my dream now with the publishing of this book.
We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with Mr. Canale.
Okay, Murfreesboro, the quack is back. That's right, you heard it here first. The Ducks are back in town on June 23rd for the Sudsy's Car Wash Child Advocacy Center Rubber Duck Derby. We plan to float 10,000 rubber ducks down the Stones River, all to raise money for the Child Advocacy Center of Rutherford and Cannon Counties. $5 gets a duck entered into the race for a chance to win a $5,000 cash grand prize. Starting in May, you can adopt your ducks online at duckrace.com/Murfreesboro.
Some of you might have heard of the Doughboy Challenge for Charity. Well, it's back. I'm Katie and I work for General Mills here in Murfreesboro, and I'm excited for this year's 7th annual Doughboy Challenge, a 5K run to raise money for 3 local charities. This year, we are partnering with Nash Vegas Rollers, the Exchange Club, and CASA of Rutherford County. Last year, we raised over $35,000, and this year, our goal is over $50,000. On June 9th, be a part of our 5K on the Square. Bring the kids and be a part of our local Murfreesboro community. If you have questions or want to register, check out DoughboyChallenge.com.
This is Good Neighbor Events, brought to you by the Omni Hut Restaurant in Smyrna, AmeriCare Pest Control, and the Rutherford Home Show, Saturday mornings at 11:30 on WGNS.
If you're planning to buy a home, choose a professional that will look out for you. Ann Hoke & Associates has a proven track record of helping guide clients through the home buying experience. Whether buying your first home, moving up, downsizing, or investing, Ann's team will help you do it right. When it's your time to buy or sell, just ask Ann.
This is Ann Hoke at Keller Williams Realty. I would love to personally talk with you. Call me today at 397-4024. Sell faster and buy smarter with Ann Hoke & Associates.
Works by the Murfreesboro Art League are on display in the rotunda of the Murfreesboro City Hall now through May the 6th. Now, the 15th annual Bible Reading Marathon will be here in town starting Sunday afternoon, April the 29th, and continuing 24/7 all the way up to the National Day of Prayer. That's at noon on Thursday, May the 3rd. This year it's over at the Bible Pathways Ministries at 810 West Thompson Lane. If you have any questions or would like to be a part of this, call Karen Hawkins, 896-4243. And the March of Dimes for Babies is scheduled for Sunday afternoon, May the 6th. Circle this on your calendar. Registration's at 1 o'clock over at the DePaul Medical Office Building, right there at the Middle Tennessee Medical Center campus, Sunday, May 6th. The two-mile walk begins at 2 o'clock. And when you walk, you give hope to the more than 500,000 babies born too soon each year. My granddaughter was born at 24 weeks, and thanks to the research at the March of Dimes, she's a little over 1 year old and doing great. Let's get behind the March of Dimes for Babies Walk on Sunday, May 6th at Middle Tennessee Medical Center. And those are Good Neighbor events.
Today is Thursday, April the 26th. Our WGNS birthday cake winner today is Vincent Beatty Bird. The folks over there at the City Cafe called that birthday in. Vincent Beatty Bird, our WGNS birthday cake winner for today.
Hi, I'm Dr. Patrick Showalter.
And I'm Dr. Chad Jackson. Did you know that Middle Tennessee Medical Center is home to the Da Vinci Surgical Robot and that we are the first surgeons to use the robot in Rutherford County?
When faced with prostate cancer, the Da Vinci robot makes surgery an excellent option.
It allows for quicker recovery, less blood loss, and studies suggest it may be the most effective, least invasive treatment option for improving cancer outcomes.
For more information or to find a Da Vinci robot certified physician, visit mtmc.org.
This is Beverly Barker at Southern Community Bank, formerly Community First Bank and Trust. While our name has changed, the same people are here to serve your banking needs. Southern Community Bank is a strong, independent community partner with a simple philosophy. Keep banking hassle-free for people who just want to be treated well.
Southern Community Bank, 1950 Old Fort Parkway, next to Doubletree.
Come see why at Southern Community Bank we're unlike all the rest.
Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
WeatherEye.
We'll continue to see lots of clouds throughout the afternoon with a chance of showers and thunderstorms, some strong, reach a high in the low 80s. Tonight, slight chance of showers and storms. I'm WGNS meteorologist Laura Lockwood. Right now, it's
Play It Again Sports!
Your golf headquarters.
Get new and quality used golf clubs from Nike, TaylorMade, Callaway, pre-owned, and more. Save money on drivers, hybrids, wedges, and iron sets and accessories at Play It Again Sports on Thompson Lane.
The local conversation continues now on The Truman Show. Once again, here's Truman Jones.
And welcome back with Dan Goodwin. Oh, I'm sorry. Why did I say Dan Goodwin, Dan Whittle?
Well, Robert, I can't imagine why you did that.
Thank you. And we want to let you know that this part of the show is brought to you by Gordon Ralston Photography at 315 Hickerson Drive in Murfreesboro. And you can call them at 396-8776 or pull them up on the internet, www.gordonralstonphoto.com. And Al Gordon, a master craftsman photographer, and Larry Ralston, certified craftsman, both hometown guys right here, are the most awarded studio in the Middle Tennessee area operating a full-service photographic studio in Murfreesboro. They specialize in weddings, high school seniors, and family portraits. Their work is classic yet current with a creative edge. Al was even awarded the Grand Award for the best wedding image in the world. Gordon Ralston looks forward to meeting you and will treat you like family. And I'll guarantee you they will. I mean, some of the nicest people that I know. We're over in Kanalu.
Farming culture in the 1930s.
Yeah. And what was it? I mean, you've already talked about cotton. What were the main crops that you would come out of there during that time?
I got what they call cotton patch religion at age five. Uh-huh. And my mother done strapped one of those little cotton
Miss
sacks
Ruby.
On me. Miss Ruby.
Yeah.
You know my mother.
Yes, I did.
A classic farm lady.
Yes.
And she hooked one of those little tow sacks around my shoulder and said, "You're a cotton picker, boy." And so that afternoon, that first day, I remember it was about 100 degrees in the cotton patch, and she caught me praying to Big God. About 3 months before she passed away, she asked me if I remembered that cotton patch prayer. And I said, "Ma'am, I can recite that cotton patch prayer." She said, "To do it." And I said, "Well, Big God, this is little Danny Whittle. If you don't mind, don't make me no cotton picker when I grow up." See, prayer works. It's been a long time since I picked any cotton. I was trying to write even back then before I went to school. In fact, I learned part of my ABCs by going through Sears Roebuck catalogs, which was a big day on the farm when those new catalogs would arrive.
The Sears and Roebuck catalogs were the most interesting things that you would ever receive, because you could use them for so many things.
You could order your clothes. Yes. You could even order your house. Yes. You could build a house. In fact, there's a 1910 house in Smyrna, mm-hmm. Sears Roebuck House, that Dorothy Jean and Johnny Barnett reside in today, built mm-hmm. in 1910, a Sears Roebuck House. You could order farm equipment. Mm-hmm. It also had a place in the shack out back, which yeah. is where I learned to...
That's where you recycled it.
That's where we recycled it. Uh-huh. And it was a lot more cushy than the corn cobs.
Yes, so it most certainly was.
People think I'm making this up, but this was the way it was.
People our age know you're not making it up. But you have such a creative mind. I mean, you really do. You're interested in so many things. How was it with you in an area like that? I'm sure that there was probably a newspaper there or hopefully a radio station, yeah. where people could actually get the right type of news.
I take my creative probably after my father. He had a very...
Who was the gambler?
He was a gambling man when he mm-hmm. wasn't in the off season of farming. He gambled mm-hmm. over on the riverboats at Cairo, Illinois, and the nightclubs over there. He was a good gambler mm-hmm. and paid for our farm a lot with gambling money.
Before I forget it, tell me about you running into some people who knew your dad.
1996, my wife Pat and I went to Missouri to move my mother to Tennessee in the mm-hmm. nursing home. Mother had already got old and was in failing health. We stopped at Wickliffe, Kentucky, right on the Mississippi River, to let our little dog, Precious, excuse herself. Mm-hmm. And I spied three old gentlemen spitting and whittling over there right beside the river.
My kind of people.
They could put their toes in the river
right.
that day. I walked over there and I said, "Gentlemen, my name is Whittle and I can't whittle a lick." Well, they were whittling on cedar sticks. One of them spit a big wad of tobacco and said, "I knew a Whittle. Farmer over in the Boot Hill of Missouri across the river." I said, "Was his first name Hubert?" "That's him, Hubert Whittle. Good gambling man, except when he drank too much whiskey." He knew my father well.
Did your dad ever let you go on any of the gambling trips?
Yes.
He did.
That was the first time I learned to keep secrets. If I've ever told anybody that I would keep a secret or the confidence, I've never broke it. And my daddy, I would sit on his knee sometime while he gambled poker. He's a great poker player.
Now, when they gamble... I presume it was it legal or illegal? And some, I'm sure the legal gambling, a lot of it was on the boats when they were on the river.
The illegal gambling, and he had some hood friends out of Chicago that he knew well as far as hoodlums. But that type of gambling was considered legal mm-hmm. On the Illinois side of the river. Now, it was not legal over the Missouri side of the river. In our little hometown, the town marshal, the main gambling room was in the back of the barber shop, who was the barber was also the town marshal, so it was pretty wide open era.
Things never changed, did they?
Nah. and people that lived outside of our little farming community knew not to bruise our feelings or our egos, that we'd whip your butt.
Now, what kind of card playing did your dad play? Was it something like three card stud or
yeah,
something like that?
And mostly five card stud.
Uh huh.
Yeah, and he was a great at bluffing, and he just had to doubt. Now,
now what did he do when he lost?
He didn't lose that often, but he took it like a man.
I presume that he was like a lot of people that gamble. He knew how much that he could afford to lose, and he
yeah.
would only go so far.
Smart man. You got to be a smart man to gamble, be a good gambler. Very intelligent, very quick.
Well, that runs the up and down, either
yeah.
smart or not so
yeah.
smart.
Yeah, well, it depends on how you look at it.
Yeah.
But he was a good gambling man, rough. An interesting thing about my family, it wasn't until 5 years ago, and we look very much like the people I'm fixing to talk about. My uncle, Harlan Whittle, which was Daddy's last living sibling, he died 5 years ago, called me to Missouri. Mm-hmm. Back to Missouri, he says, "I want to tell you something about the family history." And of course, that always fascinated me. I'm like you. I love history.
Right.
Went up there, and he said, "Danny boy, we've never told any of y'all, your generation, this, but your grandmother, my mother, was full-blood Choctaw, and mm-hmm. her mother was full-blood Choctaw. And we never knew this. the reason we did not know this is the family kept it secret because as recent as 1950s and 1960s, if you were well connected politically, you could take farmland away from Native Americans.
You're kidding.
No. It's fact.
Yeah, I just wonder what percentage we're talking about, because I know that in my family tree, and go back a few generations, one of my relatives was Cherokee. Well, it says Indian. It doesn't mm-hmm. say where it's Cherokee or Apache or whatever. It just says Indian. And I thought it find a kind of interesting, and I don't know how I could find out, but I guess I could. Her name is not mentioned. All it says is Indian woman. And I always wondered why, because we've all asked that question.
I wonder, there'll be one day that we can sit at home and do DNA tests to ourselves and things, and we'll find out that we're not all white, we're not all black, we're not all Native Americans. We are a culture that is blended. I'm wondering if that will ever help end what we call racism in American society. I hope so.
Well, if the people get their minds right and just forget all of that and just note the fact that we're all individuals. I mean, I even have the problem of titles. I have a real major problem, even in politics, Democrat or Republican. I have a problem with that. I am one of these people that I look at the individual and see what type of qualifications, what kind of guy he is, and is he going to be somebody that is going to be positive for our country? You know, that's always my major concern, is what's going to be good for the government of the United States, because the government of the United States is us, as Pogo would say, is us.
Yeah. Getting back to the culture, the last gunfight on Main Street, 1952, July 4th, was a black man and a white man. You would not believe what the argument was. And neither one of them owned farmland. That fight, that life and death fight, started over which farmer in the neighborhood had the first cotton bloom.
You're kidding.
Neither of the combatants owned a clot of dirt, but that's what started the fight.
It sounds like that they had a grudge going before that, I would hope.
And I think they were both on hooch.
Yeah. Hooch is made up of is just pure whiskey.
Yeah.
Did you guys have moonshine stills there?
Absolutely. Yeah.
I was wondering how that would moonshine still would work over in that area, because you're in swamp country, which you think of moonshine of pure running water on rocks.
One of my chapters deals with this man that had the legal whiskey certificate from the Army and the government. Mm-hmm. This was in the 1880s, just after the Civil War. He made whiskey and was a very wealthy man. In fact, owned slaves up until the Civil War. And the illegal distillers got him out drunk one night and poisoned him and killed him because he wouldn't share his recipe for making his whiskey. And a good friend of mine who helped me do this book has the records and all of the inventory from that farm and the slaves and the whiskey, even down to how many gallons that he left to be merchandised, marketed.
While you're talking, I keep thinking, it must have been tough to be an educator, a teacher in that area, because everybody knows everybody, and it sounds like not everybody wants to play the same game.
Well, in my second grade school year was very traumatic. For example, we'll take the side of the teacher. I walked in second grade, and this teacher did not like me immediately, and I did not like her. I got 7 whippings in the second grade. I got 3 of those whippings within a 15-minute time span. What happened was my little girlfriend named Rosemary had handed me a note, and I had handed her a note, do you like me, I like you, that kind of thing. Well, the teacher got on Rosemary, which made me mad. Mm-hmm. When I run my mouth, she gave me a whipping right there at the desk. When she went back up to her desk, about 5 minutes, this is when I think I started my writing career, effective communications. About 5 minutes later, I wrote a note and crawled on my hands and knees out of sight of the teacher and deposited a little note on her desk. Mm-hmm. About 5 minutes later, I heard this roar. It was the teacher. She had found the note. Now, I was always a mannerly little boy. It said, "Dear Mrs.
Sounds
Cox."
Like it.
Yeah. "Dear Mrs. Cox, I hate your guts very much." Not being a bright child, I signed the note, "Little Danny Whittle."
Mm-hmm.
Another whipping. All right. After that whipping, she left a big book on my desk after she flogged me the second time. She got back up to the front of the room. She said, "Little Danny Whittle, get that book up to me now, pronto." She didn't say how to send the book. I airmailed the book. The book hit her right on top of the head, big encyclopedia, like to knock her down, everything. Third whipping within 15 minutes. That was a school record.
You've always had a problem with authority, haven't you?
Anyway, getting back to that, to your point of mm-hmm. teachers, primarily because of me, that teacher had to leave Canaloo School.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I was...
You had a lot of power back then, didn't you?
Well, I was a little pet of the community because my dad had got killed the year before, so I was kind of a little town pet, and everybody loved me except that one teacher, and they fired her, made her move to away.
Did you ever try to utilize your talents as a writer back in that time?
Yeah.
Really? I mean, did you? Did they have a newspaper or some area that you could go to?
When I was 17, a man that owned the drive-in theater in mm-hmm. Sykeston, Missouri, which is 12 miles from our little farm town, mm-hmm. he recognized something in me, and he recommended me for a job down at the local newspaper there in Sykeston.
Mm-hmm.
I went in thinking I was applying for a janitor's job,
mm-hmm.
and the publisher asked me, he says, as I was entering the door, he says, "Can you type?" And I'm thinking, man, this must be a pretty classy janitor's job, having no little typing. Then he asked me, he said, "Well, how long it is, son, that you've been wanting to write sport?" Had a unique way of phrasing things. And I lied like a dog. I said, "Sir, I've been wanting to write sports all my life." He hired me later because of my audacity and veracity. Well, Truman, I thought he was cussing me with those two big words.
Now, did you have an editor? Because I know everywhere that you've been, you've had an editor that has influenced your writing.
Paul Bumbarger was my first editor. He was a detail man. He taught me accuracy. I mean, be accurate. And my second editor was Bob York. He was so old that he had literally covered the Indian Wars.
Oh, wow.
And you're talking about some colorful professional people. It was an interesting era. It was the height of newspaper in American history, the heyday of what I call the newspaper
era.
Been
going downhill since then.
It has, yeah.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with you.
Hi, I'm Wade Hayes, owner of Toots, Good Food and Fun. I strongly believe that volunteers make a positive difference in the quality of life here in our community.
Doran Claiborne is our Toots Outstanding Volunteer. He's always helping and encouraging young people. In addition to being active with the Middle Tennessee Christian School Board, Doran is past president of Murfreesboro Rotary. When no one volunteered to head Rotary's involvement in a recent race, he quickly agreed to take on the responsibility. That's just one of many times Doran Claiborne has stepped forward to volunteer his talents. Doran Claiborne is our Toots Outstanding Volunteer.
At Toots, we strongly believe that it's important for every one of our citizens to give some of their time and talent back into the community. We've been so blessed here in Rutherford County, and we want to honor these individuals with a Toots gift certificate good at any of our three Rutherford County locations. Our original Toots on Northwest Broad Street, Sam Ridley Parkway in Smyrna, and our newest location at South Church Street and Barfield Road.
You know us as a leader in healthcare and pharmacy products, but did you know that Reeves Sane is known for high standards in respiratory services, from highly trained respiratory therapists to our outstanding delivery team? This is Lori Sane Smith at Reeves Sane. We offer all oxygens, CPAP and BiPAP machines, masks and supplies, as well as nebulizers for both adults and children. We offer 24-hour service so that we're always here when you need us. That's the Reeves Sane way. Reeves Sane Medical, 1809 Memorial Boulevard.
If you have a yard or maybe a field, you may plan on digging in it. Perhaps you want to put in a swimming pool, add a super awesome barbecue pit, or bury a comically large chest of pirate booty.
Harg!
But before you dig, you should know that there are buried pipelines in lots of places. If you dig and hit one of these pipelines, it could cause a leak, and that could cause serious problems.
Sorry.
Call your local natural gas utility or visit pipesafety.org. Brought to you by the Tennessee Gas Association.
Now that the weather is getting warmer, outdoor events are not far behind. This is Rich Schmidt with more spring savings from Haynes True Value Hardware. Haynes True Value Hardware has a quad chair for only $6.99 while supplies last. This durable fabric chair with comfortable armrests and built-in beverage holder is perfect for relaxing in the backyard or on the sidelines, and it provides maximum stability on grass or concrete, thanks to a sturdy steel frame. Only $6.99 while supplies last. Pick up yours today at Haynes True Value Hardware, behind Reeves Hayne Drugstore on Memorial.
Weather-eye.
We'll continue to see lots of clouds throughout the afternoon with a chance of showers and thunderstorms, some strong, reach a high in the low 80s. Tonight, slight chance of showers and storms. I'm WGNS meteorologist Laura Lockwood. Right now, it's 79 degrees.
If you know someone who has gone the extra mile, nominate them to be Good Neighbor of the Day. Just send those nominations to news@WGNSradio.com or stop in our studios at 306 South Church Street.
Now more of The Truman Show with Truman Jones on WGNS AM and FM.
And welcome back with Dan Whittle. And where in the world were we?
We were at Canalu, Missouri. The book coming out, Canalu, the people, the culture, Boot Hill Town.
How in the world did they get? I know that if you look at Missouri, the bottom part is kind of flat running across, and then there's that little imprint that you guys call the boot.
Yeah.
And the boot is where Canalu is.
The standing joke, and I did not know this until I moved to Tennessee, the standing joke in Kansas City and St. Louis, which is the two big metropolitan areas of Missouri, the standing joke is that if you gave the Boot Hill to Arkansas, it raised the IQ of both states. We never did think that joke was funny.
That was pretty funny. Now, how the people in Missouri, how are they so much different? Say, in Tennessee, we're called the three states of Tennessee. We got West, Middle, and East Tennessee. How does Southern Missouri, where you are, or were, how does that differ from the rest of the state?
The culture I grew up with, the farm neighborliness, mm-hmm. the togetherness of the community, reminds me very much of Middle Tennessee. Mm-hmm. So I think that's one reason why I've been blessed to live here. We have that kind of culture here, very caring culture. Mm-hmm. And like here, if you put a farm... A fire on the radio or on the front page of the newspaper, this community, regardless of your race, regardless of your religion, this community will help you build back.
Oh, I agree.
That's what I grew up in.
Well, now, you left there, and that had been tough on you because you left your relatives and a lot of your friends, and you established a new life over here in Middle Tennessee.
For a while, for a long time, for 15 or 20 years, I was the black sheep of the family because I did not, first in five generations that I did not farm. I read books. I was considered a little strange. Don't go there.
I don't even have to comment on that one.
But when I came to the Nashville Banner, that was sort of a big stepping stone in my industry. And
you were there with the giants. I mean, Fred Russell is
Red O'Donnell,
Larry Britton, all of those that
two out of three is not bad.
People,
you dog.
so how was it? There you were in a big town in an influential newspaper that really made or broke a lot of people, especially politicians.
Well, the interesting thing about the Banner, this is a legendary story within our industry, John Hooker.
Mm-hmm. John J. Hooker.
John
Senior.
J. Hooker, when he took control of the Banner. Mm-hmm. The Banner had done such a hatchet job on him the first time he ran for governor.
Oh, we're talking about Junior now. Or is that Senior?
We're that's talking junior. About the man that ran for governor twice.
Okay, that's Junior.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And when he got control of the Banner, one of the main reporters who had done the hatchet job folded up his desk, cleaned out his desk, and walked out the door the minute he heard John J. Hooker had control of the Banner. Because he knew he was fired anyway. One of your favorite people.
Now, a newspaper can be extremely influential in a community, no matter
if you use it right.
It can be influential either positive or negative.
Mm-hmm.
It depends. What do you think? Why are the newspapers not as strong and influential as they used to be? Is it a matter of management? Is it the ideals of the individuals? And when we talk about a newspaper, we're talking about primarily the editors. They're working off of their particular ideals and beliefs. Is that not right?
To some extent, my generation was taught to be objective, if we were caught taking a bribe or anything, brother, we were blackballed out of the industry. Mm-hmm. The toughest story I did at the Banner was the day I was on city desk as an editor that day when Wallace got shot.
Mm-hmm. George Wallace
ended his run for the presidency. Mm-hmm. We had two reporters there at that time. This was before internet or anything. I had phone pieces, earpieces in both ears from each reporter. Mm-hmm. As they were describing the shooting and the ambulances and the wild crowd and everything, each sentence that I would write in my typewriter, we had page boys ripping it out of my typewriter. Wow. You're talking about high pressure. And that night, I didn't sleep a wink because it was such high-pitched pressure, I couldn't come down.
How often did you see stories come in when you were at the Banner that you actually had to send out those famous words, hold the presses? How often did you see
two that? Times. I did it two times. And both of them involved murders.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Now, what year did you actually work over at the Banner?
71, 72, and 73. I tell people I helped put it out of business.
But there were a lot of pretty unbelievable things going on at that time.
Well, the Banner was a very award-winning, prestigious newspaper, as you said. It was one of the most respected afternoon newspapers in America, won many awards.
Well, the Banner was considered very conservative at that time. The Tennessean was a liberal paper.
We couldn't even wear a mustache or a goatee.
That's what I was going to say. You had to follow that line of thought. Now, when you were hired on at the Banner, was that part of your thinking that when you started there that you were more of a conservative thinker than a liberal? Because very rarely would you see them go off of that particular way of thinking as far as how they would send the news out to the readers.
I was considered conservative then, and I still consider myself a conservative in that I believe in balanced budgets. I believe in fiscal responsibility. I believe families ought to run that way. I think businesses got to run that way, and I think mm-hmm. our nation should run that way. So mm-hmm. that makes me a conservative. Now I would be considered very liberal, although I don't think I've changed. I believe in accountability. And one of the interesting things about the Banner and Tennessean, the relationship, those two newspapers owned a third company, the printing corporation, mm-hmm. that mass-produced both newspapers.
Right.
All right. But the Banner was on one side of the building, independent of the Tennessean. A lot of people thought the Tennessean owned the Banner at that time. It did not. Jimmy Stallman was the publisher of the Banner at
right.
that time. All right. Here was two competing newsrooms. We were an older set of conservative men, mostly mm-hmm. men. We had
right.
two or three women, one black reporter.
Mm-hmm.
And we were mostly conservative. And it was very interesting when we'd go into the shared bathroom. On the one end was the Tennessean younger folks. You could smell the marijuana being smoked down at that end. On our end, you could smell the whiskey. Yeah, it's a true story.
But you know, we've always heard that competition brings the best out of everybody.
Oh, I agree.
And there is no doubt that when the Banner went out of business, I think it hurt the Tennessean. Because
it hurts the community, too.
It really does, because you have the conflict in beliefs that are out there in front of everybody for someone to grab onto, whichever way that they were thinking at the time. And once they left that, it seems like things just really weren't the same anymore.
It's hurt America. I agree with you there.
I think the loss of respect for print has really been a major part of some of the things that have gone wrong in this country. I really do believe that.
I agree with you. My book is going to be out in about 30 days. I think it's going to be out in the Amazon, and how they can acquire it. Of course, we don't have the prices yet or anything, but as soon as that happens, I'll let you know how people can get the book.
Will it be more than a dollar?
For you, yes, it will be more than a dollar.
Now, What size are we talking about? How many pages are you going to have in your book?
I've got 91 chapters.
91 chapters. Ooh, yeah. That's going to be a big book.
It's a good book.
Yeah. And it's going to be an interesting book because I have gone through some of the leaflets that you've got in here, and I'm actually going to pay for it, but I want you to sign it when I get it. Now, will it be available in any of the bookstores here in Murfreesboro?
Yes. I don't know which ones yet, but yes, it will be. That's already been agreed to. It's being published by Southeast Missouri State University, and they've already got agreements, and I don't know which stores they're talking to.
I imagine that they will end up probably having that book there. But what is the title?
Canaloo.
And is that spelled the same way as cantaloupe?
C-A-N-A-L-O-U, Canaloo.
Oh, okay.
Where goes the channel?
Okay.
All right. Canaloo, the people, the culture, Boot Hill Town.
Well, it has been an absolute pleasure having you on.
Thank you.
As always. And I appreciate you not buying my lunch today, as usual. And I hope you have a good day. I hope Pat has a better day.
I do, too. She deserves it.
I'm sure real estate is doing well in
it
Smyrna.
It is picking up. It is really picking up.
Well, tomorrow we will be back with you and have Mr. Billy Henson on. See you tomorrow.